It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, as spring break nears, our guest says there are precautions that travelers who are looking to destinations further south should keep in mind given the Zika outbreak.
But first, we're following the news that Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson is one of a handful of Senate Republicans willing to meet with Merrick Garland, President Obama's Supreme Court nominee, announced earlier this week.
That doesn't mean those Republicans would vote to confirm Garland or even hold confirmation hearings, meaning the confirmation could be in limbo for months.
Joining us now to talk about the latest on the politics behind the nomination is Amber Phillips. She covers politics at The Washington Post. Amber, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
Well, can you give us a sense of how many Republican senators might be, perhaps, willing to bend toward meeting or maybe a hearing with President Obama's Supreme Court nominee?
Yeah, so meeting is a little bit easier to count. Right now, there's, by my count, six senators, including, as you mentioned, Senator Ron Johnson, who've indicated or even said outright they'd be willing to sit down with Judge Merrick Garland. One of those is quite a powerful senator in this process. It's Chuck Grassley, who heads the Senate committee that's in charge of even, you know, holding hearings for Garland and considering him. But, you know, huge caveat here, almost all of those senators say this meeting means nothing. It's a common courtesy. You know, one senator, I think it was Susan Collins of Maine, even said, I'm just sitting down with him to explain to him why I won't vote for him or why I won't, you know, I won't even consider him. And so I think optimistic Democrats might read this as a sign that Republicans are starting to see the light about Merrick Garland. But I would argue it's just, you know, them extending a common courtesy, really.
So if it means nothing, why bother with the formality? Is there the sense that it will appeal to a certain subset of voters who might be interested in what they do?
Yeah, well, that's the question. I think everyone's trying to balance this small slice of truly independent voters, especially in states like Wisconsin, where they're trying to game out on both sides, you know, if those voters, A, are even paying attention to this confirmation battle and who sits down with who and who talks with who, and if those voters are going to make that an issue when they go to the ballot box. I think almost everyone agrees that it's probably not the main issue that's going to drive most people off their couch and to go vote, but it could be something that sways an independent voter, you know, when they're deciding between Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold, you know, in November, for example. And so I wonder if Senate Republicans in agreeing to meet with Garland are seeing how that plays out. You know, like they can sort of back off the claim that they're being obstructionist by saying, hey, I sat down with the guy. I chatted about, you know, his judicial philosophy. I don't think he's right, and I don't think the time is right to nominate him.
Is there any polling out there about what this group of independent voters could possibly want to see?
Yeah, we have some interesting polling from the Washington Post recently, and it came out before President Obama announced Judge Garland was his choice for the Supreme Court. But it showed that by a margin of 2-1, independent voters support the Senate holding hearings. So, you know, that suggests when you break that down among Democrats and Republicans, it's clearly along party lines. But this polling of independent voters suggests that they might be amenable to Democrats' arguments that Senate Republicans aren't doing their job, that they're breaking with historic precedent and with the constitutional duties and not, you know, even considering Garland. So I think there is, you know, there are Republicans who have to be conscious of how this plays out among those truly undecided independent voters.
And you mentioned some names in a group of Republican senators who might be willing to bend, maybe to meet with Merrick Garland, President Obama's Supreme Court nominee, and use the umbrella vulnerable. Who else is in that group, and how vulnerable are they?
Yeah, well, there's a handful, I would say, about 3, 4, 5, 6 Senate Republicans who are up for re-election in states that are either blue, like Senator Mark Kirk in Illinois, or kind of, you know, purple or swingy, and tend to get more blue in Democratic in a presidential year. That would include Senator Ron Johnson, in Ohio, Senator Rob Portman, Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire, all these guys and gals kind of have to really watch their steps in November, because Democrats have put up, for the most part, formidable challengers to these Senate Republicans, and are hoping to kick them out in a presidential year when Democrats tend to come out and vote in higher numbers. And so there's about 3, 4, 5, 6 Senate Republicans that really have to walk a tightrope right now, and having this Supreme Court confirmation battle front and center for them is tough, definitely not what they wanted.
Amber Phillips is a political reporter for The Washington Post, and we're talking with her right now about the latest on the Supreme Court nomination of Merrick Garland, whether there is a group of senators who could be willing to meet, maybe showing signs of softening toward Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court. And another group, we talked about some of the vulnerable senators. What about the centrists who don't have a lot to lose?
Right. Yeah, there are some longtime Senate Republicans who have been in the Senate, like I said, for a long time, who are kind of institutionalists and can make the argument. Susan Collins of Maine, who I just mentioned, is one of them, can make the argument, I think that it's never been done before in history to hold up a Supreme Court nominee for an entire year. I think we're stretching it a little bit too much, guys. Let's at least hold hearings. We don't have to vote for the guy. We don't have to confirm it, but let's at least look, like we're trying to consider him. And I say those guys don't have a lot to lose because they've been in the Senate for a long time. They're not facing primary challengers. They're not facing general election challengers. Most of them are in pretty safe Republican states. And I think if everyone in the Senate were in that situation, we might be having a totally different conversation about Judge Garland and whether he gets nominated. But the fact of the matter is that really control of the Senate hinges on November, and whether these vulnerable incumbents can keep their jobs. And so I just think that Senate Republicans have decided the best way to keep control of the Senate is to really hold the line and not bother to consider Judge Garland at all.
Is there a sense at all among these groups of senators that you're talking about, the centrists, the vulnerable, that by meeting with Merrick Garland that they are somehow crossing Mitch McConnell and could have a price to pay down the road?
That's a great question. Mitch McConnell, of course, at the very beginning said, we're not going to hold hearings within hours of Justice Scalia dying. And then he has since come out and said, I'm not going to be meeting with him either. But you watch the guy who's right there along with McConnell, holding the line, Chuck Grassley from Iowa, saying, I'd be okay to meet with him. But I get the sense that Democrats feel Senate Republicans are not on message at all, because you do have some being willing to meet with them, some saying they'd take a vote, others wondering out loud whether the Senate might confirm Garland in the lame duck session. You get the sense that Senate Republicans aren't necessarily on message, but I don't know that indicates that they are crossing or trying to undermine their leader. For the most part, all of them, including vulnerable incumbents, say, hold the line and say that they're not going to vote for him.
And what about, these meetings happen, maybe an actual a hearing happens, that this thing could pick up some momentum and become harder to stop?
Sure, that's quite possible. Never say never, especially in this election cycle. And if that happens, I think it comes down to two things. One, the Senate is a place for one person, and one person in particular, the leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, has ultimate power whether to hold a vote or not. And if he decides, as he has, that this is the best course to keep the Senate, he's not going to bring Garland up for a vote, even if he comes out of, sterling reviews out of the committee that reviewed him. But then I think, let's say, even then, if McConnell decides to acquiesce and let a vote happen, you need 14 Senate Republicans to join with Democrats to overcome a filibuster that Senator Ted Cruz has promised to launch to confirm him. And it's really tough to see 14 Republicans crossing party lines, especially when things are so polarized right now.
And Amber, just very quickly before we let you go, Jim from Rice Lake has a question. He wants to know, could Republicans quick rush Merrick Garland's approval if Clinton were to be elected?
You know, that is something that Senate Republicans have wondered out loud. I heard Senator Jeff Flake from Arizona asked that out loud to reporters yesterday. And the thought process there is, of course, if Clinton is wins the nomination and then becomes president in November, we wake up and she's suddenly indicating that she's going to nominate someone super far to the left. Suddenly, Merrick Garland, who for all intents and purposes is relatively moderate, might look pretty nice to Republicans. But that being said, it's a possibility, but the Senate's number two, John Cornyn, quashed that down yesterday pretty quickly. He just said it's just not appropriate to be approving someone to the Supreme Court in a lame duck session of Congress. That brings up a whole host of constitutional and politically thorny questions.
Amber, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Amber Phillips. She covers politics for The Washington Post. She joined us there to talk about the latest on the Supreme Court nomination of Merrick Garland.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we talk about cooking with mushrooms for this week's Food Friday.
First, we turn to some recent travel advisories. As the weather warms up, spring breakers and other travelers look south toward popular vacation destinations. Many have been cautioned about popular Zika-affected vacation destinations in Latin America and the Caribbean. Some airlines like Delta, American Airlines, and United are even offering full refunds to travelers who've booked tickets to those affected areas.
And since the virus has been seen as a likely cause of birth defects, the CDC has released guidelines for women who are pregnant or are trying to get pregnant in particular. And our guest has recommendations for both women and men who might be in or near areas impacted by the virus.
Joining us now is Dr. Katie Antoni. She's a maternal fetal medicine physician at UW Health. Dr. Antoni, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Before we get into specific travel advisors, can you remind us of some of the symptoms of Zika and who in particular might be at risk?
Sure, of course. Zika infection itself generally has a pretty mild infection. About 75 to 80% of infected individuals are asymptomatic altogether. And those who are infected, symptoms include things like a fever, rash, conjunctivitis, and joint aches. In a very small minority, develop Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is characterized by, rapid onset muscle weakness caused by the immune system. But again, that's pretty rare. The majority of people, again, are asymptomatic, and those who are symptomatic generally don't have long-term serious complications. The problem is if a pregnant woman is infected with Zika virus, there's been an association between the infection with the Zika virus during pregnancy and microcephaly, which is a small head in the baby. The degree to which the head is too small can be pretty profound. And in the few case reports and in the retrospective reviews published in the literature, it appears the virus kind of may hone to the brain tissues and prevent growth. And it can also cause other abnormalities within the brain and prevent the baby from growing well. In some instances, women who've been infected with Zika virus can have stillbirths or miscarriages as well.
And if it weren't for that risk of birth defects and miscarriages, we probably wouldn't be talking about Zika very much, would we? Just the symptoms on its own for non-pregnant women.
Right. Zika virus has been around for decades, and it's something that in areas that are endemic, people have gotten, sort of throughout their life, oftentimes in childhood and not at the time that they happen to be childbearing. And so it wouldn't be a much talked about virus.
And this is something that was discovered in, I think, the 1940s, as you said, decades ago in Africa. We're seeing what the World Health Organization is calling this. It's spreading explosively, they say, through the Americas. Do we know much about why we've had this sudden spread in this hemisphere?
There are many different theories about why the Zika virus has migrated from Africa kind of across the Pacific Ocean. Some theories include, climate change, people traveling more often. One theory involves, that people came from all over the world to Brazil during the time of the World Cup. And I don't know if we have a definitive answer on it. It may be components of all of those things.
Well, let's get into travel recommendations. I was looking on the CDC website. One recommendation they have in these areas, especially for pregnant women or women who might want to get pregnant in the near future, is don't get bit by a mosquito. Now, in a mosquito zone, that doesn't seem like very helpful advice in some ways, but are there precautions that people can take that really significantly reduce the risk?
There are precautions people can take when they're in a mosquito affected area. There are, EPA registered insect repellents that they can use. insect repellents that contain ingredients such as DEET, picaridin, IR-3535. Those are all safe to use during pregnancy, and there are even picaridin treatments that can be used to spray onto the clothing. And at night, it's also recommended that if you're not in an area with air conditioning and windows that close, that you use a mosquito net. Now, obviously, none of these methods are 100%, and you know, people can be using many of these methods and still be bit by mosquitoes. So,
talking to Dr. Katie Antoni from UW Health about travel and Zika. So I guess a big question a lot of people have, a lot of women who either are pregnant or think might be pregnant in the near future, should they just cancel travel to Brazil and other Zika-affected areas? What's the latest word on that?
So the current recommendation is that women who are pregnant, who are planning to go to, you know, areas with ongoing Zika transmission, the recommendation is that they either postpone their travel until after the pregnancy is completed or cancel it altogether. And the CDC's website continues to update the list of countries that are affected with Zika, but generally it's Central America, the Caribbean, and much of the northern part of South America.
And we've seen this amazing recommendation, at least one country that's been affected to, not travelers, but to women who live there, suggesting that they postpone getting pregnant, if possible, for a couple of years in the hopes that they get this Zika virus under control. I had never heard of any recommendation like that in the past. This is new territory in some ways, isn't it?
It is. It's somewhat unprecedented to, recommend to an entire country that women not become pregnant for, 2 years. It may be because they're trying to hope that, the Zika endemic will have run its course. They obviously don't know exactly how long the Zika endemic will last in their country. But there will be challenges in among the country in women accomplishing that goal. So
now, for everyone but women who are pregnant or might soon be pregnant, say men, older people, what's the thought on them traveling? Is there a concern that, if we have lots of people going to places where Zika is spreading explosively, there's a risk that they may bring it back to the United States and help it spread here?
There is a risk that they could bring it back to the United States. There's not a current recommendation, for people who are older or men whose partners are either not pregnant or not planning to become pregnant. There's not any particular restriction or recommendation that they not travel. And at least in Wisconsin, we don't have the particular type of mosquito that carries Zika. That doesn't mean it's impossible that it couldn't be carried by another mosquito.
Right, that's one concern. And still mostly talking about southern cities in the United States, that while the exact right mosquitoes may not be there, there's ones that are close enough that they could conceivably pick up and carry the disease.
Exactly, but there's currently not a recommendation to limit travel to other individuals. So,
and the main source of spread is what we've been talking about, mosquitoes. There's been some attention here in the United States that this could be sexually transmitted. It sounds like this is way more rare than mosquito-borne transmission. Does that affect how we behave if we worry about bringing this disease back?
It does. If a man travels to a Zika affected area, for example, and comes back and his wife did not travel with him, if she is pregnant, it's recommended that they either abstain from intercourse or use a barrier protection for the remainder of pregnancy.
Now, Zika is one disease that's been in the headlines a lot, but one among many around the world. Do you have any more general recommendations for pregnant women who are traveling abroad?
Yes. Generally, the WHO also recommends that women not travel to areas that are endemic for malaria, because malaria can also have, profound impact on women who are pregnant. And so, that's another consideration. There is some overlap between the countries.
And in your line of work, has Zika been a hot topic among patients you talk to? Is this something that a lot of people are asking about?
Honestly, we're getting calls every day, and the list of calls kind of on both ends. We have women who are you know, planning to travel to areas and wondering whether they should cancel or postpone their trip. And there are also women who traveled perhaps over winter break or earlier this year before Zika was so much in the news. And now they're calling because they're concerned because they think they may have potentially been exposed to Zika virus.
Yeah, and if a woman is pregnant, she's been in a Zika area, is worried that she may have been infected, maybe even showed some of the symptoms, what should she bring this to a doctor's attention? What, if anything, could she do?
Absolutely. If a woman who is pregnant has traveled to any of the areas currently on the CDC, you know, list of Zika-affected areas, namely Central America, the Caribbean, and kind of northern part of South America, then she should bring that to her doctor's attention because there are blood tests that we can do. And we would also want to do screening ultrasounds to check the status of the fetus.
And how worried do you think we should be as we travel around areas that are infected with Zika? Is this something that should ruin our vacation, or is this a risk that we can manage?
So if you're not a pregnant individual, not planning to become pregnant, there's a small chance of Guillain-Barré, but other than that, the majority of people infected with Zika are asymptomatic, and it shouldn't be a terribly big concern. Generally, if you are traveling, we still would recommend that you use, mosquito repellent and take measures to not get mosquito bites, but otherwise you can have a good time.
Dr. Antony, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Katie Antony. She's a maternal fetal medicine physician at UW Health, sharing some recommendations for travelers considering going to areas that have been impacted by the Zika virus.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. It's Food Friday, and we're going to dig into the ins and outs of cooking with mushrooms right now, and maybe even growing our own.
Some Wisconsinites are going, they're gearing up for mushroom hunting season now that we're coming up on spring. And whether you're a fan of the morels, the shiitakes, portobello, white mushrooms, or you don't even know where to start, our next guest has recipes for mushroom cooking veterans and rookies.
And we'd like to hear from you. What is your favorite recipe for cooking with mushrooms? Maybe a particular variety you like to use? Well, you can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now is Terry Milligan. She's a chef and culinary speaker and instructor who teaches classes around the state. Her food articles appear in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the Edible Door magazine. Terry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into cooking with mushrooms, you wrote recently about doing something that I think most people haven't, growing your own. So talk about how you made your or grew your own mushrooms at home and how they came out.
Well, an easy way for a novice to start in some mushroom growing is to get a mushroom kit that you can do in your home. And you don't have to have a backyard. You can have an apartment, a condo. All you need is a room that has a window with some kind of indirect light, a spray bottle, and the mushroom kit. And you can grow a couple of pounds, actually, of some fun mushrooms right in your own home, not in a backyard, but inside.
Do they actually taste better? I know if you've got a garden and you just pick your own tomatoes, it's delicious, but is there a benefit with growing your own mushrooms?
There really is. Just think of the time frame that a mushroom has to go through once it's picked and gets to your kitchen if you're going to the grocery store. And a lot of times, if you've seen shiitake mushrooms, especially in grocery stores, they're in big baskets now that you can kind of pick your own, but sometimes they're shriveled up because they've been picked for a while and they're getting dry. When you pick your own, you're actually just taking a paring knife and slicing them right off of the substrate that it's growing on. So they're really, really fresh and very moist.
That sounds great. I once had an old rental house where it turned out we were growing mushrooms in the basement, but I didn't eat any of those. That just didn't seem right.
Well, there are some you don't want to eat.
Definitely.
Well, so aside from an old rental house, what do you grow your mushrooms on? Do you need a specific piece of wood?
Well, when you do them inside, you usually get a kit that is sold by a specific company that does these types of kits because they come all ready for you. And it's a neat thing to do with kids, too, because you can show them how mushrooms grow. It only takes about 10 days to 2 weeks to actually get mushrooms. One of the biggest places that sells these kits and anything to grow to get mushrooms to grow outside as well is in almost our own backyard. It's in Peshtigo, called Field and Forest Products. They're one of the largest supplier of items for growing your own mushrooms. And that's where I get my kits when I want to grow mushrooms inside or use them at a cooking class that I want to show folks. And you can pick from 7 or 8 different varieties that come. When you get the kit, it's just going to look like a piece of sawdust, because it is. It's hardwood sawdust, but it's been inoculated with that specific mushroom spawn. And you moisten it up overnight in water, put a little plastic bag over it, and mist it every day, and in 8 to 10 days, you've got mushrooms.
Well, now let's get cooking with the mushrooms. And Terry, I got to say, I've oven roasted a lot of vegetables and I've cooked a lot of mushrooms. A lot of your recipes, though, involve something I hadn't done, oven roasting the mushrooms. Why is that such a great way to cook them?
Well, it's nice because it brings out the flavor of the mushroom and makes it kind of crisp, but you don't lose all the juice that you do. Sometimes when you saute a mushroom, you'll see a lot of liquid coming out of them, and that's a lot of the flavor. If you're doing it in that high heat in the oven on a sheet pan where you're just kind of spreading them, kind of toss them with a little bit of olive oil, you're getting all the flavor kind of stays into that mushroom, so you get a lot more mushroom flavor out of it.
I had roasted mushrooms for the first time in a restaurant in Madison, and I had never had them prepared that way before. And I have to say, there was kind of a revelation that they could taste like it. They're actually kind of crispy and everything.
They do. They get a little crispness on it. You don't want to get them burnt, so you got to watch them. But, yeah, a little crispness. In fact, on my website, there's a picture of them coming out of the oven on the baking sheet pan. And it depends on the mushroom type. Some of them will get a little crisper than others because they have less kind of a water content in it. So like a shiitake would be a little crisper than maybe a cremini mushroom, which has a little bit more moisture in it.
We are talking about cooking with mushrooms. Terry Milligan is with us. She's a chef here in Wisconsin. She teaches cooking around the state. And she's got some articles about cooking with mushrooms, recipes that you can find, a link from the Central Time Facebook page. So talk us through some of the basic mushroom types we'd be most likely to use, Terry.
Well, I think one of the most easily recognizable in everyone's kitchen or in everyone's grocery store is the shiitake. So I think you're going to find that mushroom is one of the first ones that somebody might see and recognize and maybe have eaten. Then there's oyster mushrooms, which I love. Oyster mushrooms, though, in the stores you'll find, and they look, I don't, it's hard to describe them, but like little kind of trees of mushrooms growing on each other. And they're usually a grayish, kind of bluish color, light blue, gray color in the stores. But you can get them in a variety of hues, from pink and orange to the white, which they call parchment, and then the gray color. And those are fun to cook with. Then there's a neat mushroom called the lion's mane, and this is another one that they do have a little tabletop farm for, and it looks like a puffball. They're very small, but they look like like a little puffball that you'd find, and you can just kind of saute those in butter and just kind of pop them in your mouth. They're really, really delicious.
Yeah.
So those are some interesting types. And then, of course, you know, you have your portobellas and your creminis and things like that. But you don't really grow the portobellas at home that much.
No, a lot of people, not a lot of people, but there is a certain group of people out there who says that they don't like mushrooms, period, and they kind of lump them all into one category. You just listed tons of different kinds.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you say to people who just think that they don't like eating mushrooms?
Well, I think they need to try them in different types of recipes and go beyond just a regular mushroom that's a white mushroom. Nothing wrong with the white button mushrooms. They're very nice on a steak and things. But there's so many other mushrooms that you can try. And if you happen, you talked about foraging earlier in the lead-in, and you cannot grow a morel at home. That is a true wild mushroom that you do have to find in the forest. But for those who are lucky enough that know where a morel might be sitting, and you get your morels, they have a really distinct flavor and are something just truly that you can't replicate except out in the wild. So, you know, just to kind of be a little bit more adventuresome, it's kind of like saying, I don't like wine. Well, there's lots of different wines, and there's lots of different mushrooms. So you just have to kind of go out on the culinary limb and try some new things.
Let's get into one of the recipes you shared with us. And this one, by the way, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page, Herb Ricotta and Roasted Mushroom Crostinis. Talk us through that one.
Well, this is such an easy recipe, and it's easy to read, but there's also a video on my site that shows you how to make it. But it's just, as we talked about, roasting the mushrooms, so you can get whatever types of mushrooms you'd like to try. And as I said, if you don't have, you're not growing your own, you can still go to the grocery store. You usually can find a variety of mushrooms. And you clean them off, put them in a little olive oil, roast them at 400 degrees in your oven till, as you said, they get a little crispy. They come out of the oven, toss them with a little bit. I used arugula, but you could use any type of little small lettuce, watercress. And then I just put it on a piece of toasted French bread. The ricotta cheese is whole ricotta, and it has a little bit of fresh basil that I put in it. Spread it on that toasted baguette slice, and on go your roasted mushrooms and arugula, little Parmesan cheese on top, and you've got a quick little appetizer.
It sounds delicious. So that's something that's not too daunting for people who just want to dip
their... It's not daunting at all, no.
Yeah, and you get to try those roasted mushrooms, which is
it's an easy
great
way. And that may be somebody who, as you said, is a little... doesn't really like mushrooms that much, they might find that this is completely different because you're going to get that different taste of a mushroom than just a sautéed and butter type preparation.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Amy is with us in Heartland. Amy, hi.
Oh, hi. I was just calling because we'll go mushrooming sometimes and we'll get morel mushrooms. And usually we'll saute them in butter or we'll add them to a soup or something. But I was wondering if you had any recipes for morel mushrooms.
Amy, thanks for the call. I like to just do them up in butter and garlic and just eat them like that. But Terry, you want to get fancier than that?
Well, that is an easy way to eat them quickly. I have actually it's called shiitake mushroom Rockefeller recipe on my website, but I have done them with, I live in Door County and we have a lot of morels. I've done that with morels as well. So clean the morels off, slice them in half and stuff them like an oyster Rockefeller, but no oyster, the receptacle is the mushroom instead. And that's kind of a fun, different preparation for that. And on my website, I have a couple of different recipes. One is a crepe that has wild mushrooms, including the morels in it. And another one is a halibut recipe that we used morels with.
Amy, thanks for that call. We're talking about cooking with mushrooms. Terry Milligan is with us. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What has been your experience cooking with mushrooms? What's your favorite recipe? What questions do you have for Terry? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page where you can see some of Terry's mushroom recipes. Again, 800-642-1234. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Riggert. And we're picking up today's Food Friday conversation on cooking with mushrooms with chef and culinary instructor Terry Milligan. And we want to hear from you. Do you like mushrooms? And what are your favorite recipes? Do you need some advice and inspiration about where to go next? And have you ever grown your own mushrooms? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page where we have some of Terry's mushroom recipes posted.
Terry, let's talk about flavor profiles, things that go well with mushrooms. It seems to me they're pretty flexible. Can they go with just about anything?
They are flexible, and I think that's because they have a distinct flavor, but it's kind of a mellow mushroom flavor. So it doesn't overpower the dish a lot. It's not something that's so strong it'll overpower another element of the dish.
And in terms of the mushroom season in Wisconsin, so it's turning towards spring now, but are we going to be able to get out and forage for some mushrooms? Is there a season for growing mushrooms and picking them?
Well, there is, and the season depends on the mushroom. Right now, your spring mushrooms are going to start. So as someone had mentioned morels, that's what we're going to start seeing. Hopefully, you know, it is weather dependent, so I think this will be a good year. But morels would be your first mushroom. And then here in Door County, where, and I think for most of the state, as the season goes into the summer, in the July, August time, you're going to start seeing things like chanterelle mushrooms, so some different types of mushrooms. But morels are always your first ones. And that really up here, because of our weather, goes through probably about September, you can still find some different types of varieties of mushrooms. But for those who want to actually grow their own outside, you can also do the method where you're going to inoculate wood or logs, your substrate, with different types of mushrooms. And if you're new to that, I recommend going to a workshop of some kind, and spring is the best time to find those workshops. And you can go online and probably find some in your neighborhood or in your area, Madison, Milwaukee, Green Bay area. Around this time, you're going to find a lot of different options for just going to a seminar to find out how to start.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Miles on the line in Milwaukee. Miles, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you want to say about cooking with mushrooms?
Well, first of all, I love the fact that you have mushrooms on as your program. It's one of my favorite foods, and not many people seem to like it. Seem to be a little bit
fat.
But what I wanted to talk about was mushroom tea, and it's something you don't hear about a lot, but if you go to, like, a lot of Chinese herb shops and things like that, they'll sell black fungus, things like that, to make really good mushroom tea out of. But I've been making it for years, and you get a lot of weird looks when you talk about it, obviously, with fungus and things like that, but it's absolutely delicious. If you like earthy tone herbal tea, you'll love this.
And, Miles, are these dried mushrooms when you buy them?
You can do dried or fresh mushrooms. I like fresh mushrooms a little better.
All right, and it just has an earthy taste, kind of like a mushroom soup maybe.
Yeah, pretty much. Exactly.
Miles, thanks a lot for that call. And, Terry, I was thinking it sounded kind of weird until I thought, oh, mushroom soup is really awesome. So I guess mushroom tea isn't that far off from that.
It depends on what flavor profile you're looking for. But you know, tea is very in, and I must say I have not tried mushroom tea, but I do see how you could create it from the mushrooms.
And there are some researchers out there who have been, you know, trumpeting the medicinal powers of mushrooms. I'm not sure what varieties. I'm sure they're all different, but I think tea is one way to go in that direction. But I also want to say, since you brought up mushroom soup, Rob, yeah. I mean, that's sort of your tried and true way of eating mushrooms, a mushroom soup. And I feel like I don't see like your classic cream of mushroom soup around much anymore. Terry, if we want to make that, how do we do that?
Well, I like to add actually some Yukon Gold potatoes with my soup when I make the mushroom soup. And that is because that gives it thickness when you puree it. So I usually start with a mushroom soup base that adds some of those potatoes in it while it's cooking, and then puree it. And it's a way to make a soup, a mushroom soup, vegetarian, because you don't have to put cream in it to make it thick. I'm trying to think if I have that on. I don't have it on my website, but it is. I will add it tonight, so if somebody wants to see that, I'll put that recipe on. But I like doing that with my mushroom soups to get the creaminess. Then what I top it with are those darn roasted mushrooms. I like to roast the mushrooms and put a few on top because it gives the soup a little crunch.
Miles, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Chef Terry Milligan about cooking with mushrooms. Terry, unusually warm weather. It's just going to get warmer as we go on. Let's get some mushrooms on the grill. Any advice for grilling with our mushrooms?
Certainly. You want to get some mushrooms that are a little meatier, so that's where those portobellos might come into play, because those are your larger mushrooms. They're going to withstand the heat of the grill, and they also make a nice, again, vegetarian option for somebody who would like a burger but doesn't want the meat, so you can use the portobello as the meat for your burger at a cookout. So mushrooms like portobellos are my first choice for grilling. You also might want to try a grill pan, just which are those kind of stainless pans or cups that go on the grill with some little perforated holes in it. Sometimes you'll lose those mushrooms going through the grill. So you don't want to lose your expensive mushrooms. Putting the grill pan on the grill will make it easier for you to keep those mushrooms on the grill and not in the coals.
And Terry, we were talking about sauteing mushrooms before, because this is a really common way to eat mushrooms. And sometimes in the recipes, you see something like, well, let the mushrooms release their liquid and then reabsorb them. But then sometimes they don't say the thing about reabsorbing the liquid. What is the rule for sauteing mushrooms?
Well, I personally like to use a hotter pan to throw them in. And again, it's just because you're going to keep some of the flavor. And I think when they release that juice, as you said, if they don't cook the juice back in, you're losing the flavor. I always think that you're going to keep the flavor in the quicker it cooks, because you're not letting any of those flavors go out into the juice form. It's like a steak. You want to keep those juices in the meat. You want to keep the juices in the mushroom.
Take another caller now. Bill is on the line in Wakefield. Bill, hi.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I just wanted to let everybody know that if they do have the extra money, please do buy the portobello or the shiitake mushrooms when you're cooking. There's such a remarkable difference in the taste. It's pretty amazing that most people just use the canned mushrooms and they're just blah. There's nothing to them, and you have the wild taste of the mushrooms. There's a restaurant in Ironwood, Michigan, Maplewood Steakhouse, and they use the portobellos on their burgers, and it's so much more filling and tasteful.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. So fresh better than canned, and portobello and shiitake better than the garden variety. Terry, he's making the case there?
Well, those are some of the easiest ones to find, and I'm very familiar with Wakefield and Ironwood because we've got a home up there, a second home up there, so I know trying to find things in grocery stores anywhere is not that easy, but up there a little difficult, and you can always find shiitakes, and you can always find portobellos, so those are easy ones for a home cook to know and reliably be able to find.
Terry, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Terry Milligan about cooking with mushrooms. Terry's a chef and culinary speaker instructor who teaches classes around the state. You can find some of her food articles in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We've got a recipe that Christini, roasted mushroom and herbed ricotta on Christini. Getting hungry as I say those words, actually. We've got that recipe linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Any inspiration for a weekend mushroom cooking?
I'm sitting here thinking about a dip that I once had that was sauteed mushrooms folded into some kind of dip, and I'm going to have to look for that.
Find that recipe again.
And roasted mushrooms. Aren't you wanting to go home and roast mushrooms?
I've never done this. Yeah, I also like them skewered on the grill, too, actually.
Yeah. You really can't go wrong.
As long as they don't all fall off, which they sometimes do. We are what we eat, they say. And according to some new research, our personalities may be defined by what flavors we like best.
Psychologists at the University of Innsbruck in Austria tried to figure out if our preferences for particular flavors were any kind of indicator for our personalities. And they had people rate four different flavors, the bitter taste, sweet taste, salty, and sour. And then they took personality quizzes, including the comprehensive assessment of sadistic tendencies.
I've never heard of it. It's hard to say. Never said it before.
But there it is.
I didn't know it existed. Well, what they found out was, this is based on a couple studies with American subjects. They suggest that, quote, bitter taste preferences, right? You like bitter food. Bitter taste preferences are associated with more pronounced malevolent personality traits, especially robustly with everyday sadism. Meanwhile, liking sweet foods tends to correlate with being agreeable. So, you like your bitter coffee. You're bitter.
You're more the bitter coffee kind of guy.
One likes bitter coffee or bitter beer, things
IPAs
like that.
IPAs is an example.
Yeah.
The bitter beer.
I don't think does that much.
Maybe that bitter chocolate. Maybe you're sadistic.
Maybe you're a bad person. Or maybe it's just one study and we don't want to go too far with it. But I like all flavors. What does that mean? I don't know.
I don't know what that means, but I think I'm going to go sadistic in your case.
Okay. Well, it stands to reason. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.